Anyway, so when you do a commentary, Joe, you're an old hand at this. Do you just chime in with a thought or two when the moment strikes or the mood strikes, or do you plan it so that you basically take the viewers start to finish all the way through, all Joe McBride, no gaps, no stoppings?
Yeah, I don't believe in gaps because I find that irritating. If you listen to a commentary and there are gaps, you're kind of stuck and wondering what's going on. So I really cram in a lot. I do a lot of research, and I try to hit the high points of what, you know, films that need commentaries or films that need context or, you know, answer controversies or fill in details. I don't just sit there and rattle off, you know, bios of people, although I do some of that because that's important too. People want to hear who is this guy and, you know, what did he do before and who wrote the play and how did they change the play. I mean, that is important too when you're, I deal with the sources of the material. And, so I do a lot of research and then I do outlining and I don't write it out like some people do, which I think is kind of stiff. So I do it like I do in class or in a lecture. I usually have a lot of notes and I thought about it carefully because part of it is you have a limited amount of time and you don't want to run out of time.
Sure.
So you have to plan it very carefully how you're going to end and how you're going to shape it. So I had a great number of notes and hit on a lot of points about World War II for Wilder. And I think the film is a big success. I think it's kind of in disguise a film about the Hollywood blacklist to some extent because it's about an informer in the midst of the POW campaign.
A suspected informer.
Well,
right?
He is an informer. You know, Peter Graves.
I thought you were talking... Well, because most of the film, the audience is led to believe, against its wishes, that it might be Bill Holden, right?
Yeah, you're right. So, I mean, it makes that point, too, that, you know, the lynch mob mentality of these guys, that you have to be careful about, you know, due process and things that were disregarded during that blacklist period. You know, a lot of Hollywood films, even though... I mean, the 50s was a really good decade for American films, oddly enough, even though two or 300 people were blacklisted, which took away a lot of talent. A lot of the films you see in the 50s are about betrayal or informing, but they have to be disguised because you couldn't make a film directly about the blacklist. You know? So there's a lot of treachery and betrayal and suspicion, and so the film is dealing with that in a covert way. And another thing I dealt with is Ace in the Hole is such a great film, but it was rejected violently by the critics and the audiences. And so Billy Wilder kind of ran for cover with his films after that until Some Like It Hot, where he kind of got back to being fully himself. And so he was adapting plays, you know, that were pre-tested properties.
Yep.
As a way of, you know, ensuring success. And so in some ways his 50s period until Some Like It Hot is spotty, but Stalag 17 really holds up very well and it's better than the play. You know, I read the play.
I never have read the play or anything. How similar is it? I've always assumed, by the way, and I don't know anything, I was total ignorance, but I always thought that Harvey Lembeck and what's his name, those two clownish guys, were add-ons, but apparently they were in the Broadway version, so there goes my theory.
Yeah, those two guys, actually. The other guy is, he was nominated for an Oscar, now I'm blanking on his name. The guy plays Animal, is what they call him.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
The clownish character. I think he's actually the weakest link in the film. Oddly, I think he really overdoes the comedy. But, you know, it's a grim subject, so you need comedy to lighten the mood. And I'm a huge admirer. Harvey Lembeck was a wonderful man. I worked with him. He was he later became a teacher, an acting teacher, and he had a acting school. And we did a tribute to Jimmy Stewart's stage activities, which people don't think about too much, but he did a lot on the stage. And Harvey, we did spoofs of... three plays if they starred Jimmy Stewart, and we had Harvey's actors do three different skits. And huh. One was Jimmy Stewart as Stanley in Streetcar Named Desire, and Jimmy Stewart in Fiddler on the Roof.
Okay.
And Jimmy Stewart in Hamlet. That was really funny.
I'd love to hear the To Be or Not to Be done by Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah, it was really great. The actors were terrific. Harvey was just a wonderful man. And then he died soon after that. He had a heart attack on the set of Mork and Mindy. He was a wonderful
fan. Oh.
But the other guy I'm trying to find out here, I'm looking, Robert Strauss.
Strauss, that's right, right.
Yeah, he got an Oscar nomination, but he was really over the top. But, you know, there's a lot of good comedy. Otto Preminger is wonderful and funny in the film. And,
yeah.
But it's a mixture of comedy and very serious drama and, you know, a lot of good acting. And William Holden... Wilder was asked by Cameron Crowe in their interview book which of his characters he liked the most. And he said Sefton in Stalag 17 is the character he related to the most in his body of work. And François Truffaut did a review of the film when it came out in France, and he really loved the film, and he said it's the triumph of an intelligent man in a world of idiots. Holden is this highly intelligent guy, and most of the other guys are kind of idiots, you know, and he's mistreated because of that, and he conquers, he wins the day over them, you know.
I love his cynical, bitter dialogue for the most part, Holden. That's what kind of sells it for me and keeps me interested. But it's interesting that he's a very... always been a very handsome leading man type, and Stalag 17 is the only film in which he's kind of almost played against that by he wears a crew cut and he's got a huge bruise on his left cheek, and because he's been beaten up by the. And he's not really like a matinee idol type at all. He looks kind of a little worse for wear, but it makes it more interesting. Yeah.
Paramount complained to Wilder all the way through that the guys were dirty and filthy, and Wilder resisted because he said that was the realism of how it was. You don't take showers more than once a week, and you're wearing the same clothes all the time. And
yeah,
you know, but he's still a really handsome guy, and he didn't like the character. He walked out of the play. He thought the character was kind of a shit, and but Wilder assured him, you know, we're building up your character. But he wanted Wilder to put in lines to make it clear that he hated the Nazis, and Wilder wouldn't do that. He didn't want to be obvious about it, you know. So Holden was kind of disgruntled when he made the film, which is kind of ironic. Actors often don't understand what they're doing, you know.
Didn't he say something along the lines of when the Oscar was handed out in early 54, didn't he say, you know, I thought that... Burt Lancaster or Montgomery Clift from Here to Eternity should have won, and they gave it to me because they felt they owed me from Sunset Boulevard or something like that, right?
Well, the story I read was his wife and he were not getting along, and she was quite, you know, nasty toward him because, I mean, he was philandering for one thing, but so she told him, she said, well, you know, you won the Oscar, but you really got it for Sunset Boulevard because that's you didn't deserve it for Stalag 17. he went home and got drunk, and he fell asleep in his tuxedo holding his Oscar. He was happy that night.
Funny.
Because she was belittling his Oscar. He should have won for Sunset Boulevard. It was won by Jose Ferrer for Cyrano. Who sees that film anymore, you know?
Yeah.
But the cast is really good, and Wilder imported several people from the Broadway production, including the authors deserve a mention. Donald Bevan, B-E-V-A-N.
Okay.
And Edmund, E-D-M-U-N-D, Trzinski, and that's hard to spell, T-R-Z-C-I-N-S-K-I.
That is hard to spell. It doesn't sound like what you're, you know. Anyway, did they adapt their own play, or how did, or did they take somebody else's play and adapt it?
No. They wrote this play, and they kept pitching it to Paramount. Paramount kept turning it down because they said it was too grim.
Mm-hmm.
So they put the play on Broadway. It was a hit, And so then Paramount wound up paying a lot of money for the rights. It's kind of satisfying. Hmm. Trzinski is in the film playing a guy called Triz, T-R-I-Z, which was his nickname. And but they improved on the play. Wilder wrote it with a guy named Edwin Blum, B-L-U-M.
Okay.
He said he was Wilder's secretary on the film. He felt that he didn't have a lot to do, but you know, Wilder's collaborators were important to him, but almost all his films he wrote with a collaborator, but he had broken up with Charles Brackett a couple of years before,
mm-hmm.
and so he was trying different collaborators, but he kept, Blum said that this is the only film where he was allowed to be on the entire production all the way through, and he was on the set, and he was involved in post-production, so he was grateful for that. But they made a lot of good changes in the play, and I go into that a lot in the commentary, that they improved on it a great deal. And they made it more serious to some extent by talking, like the setting was during the Battle of the Bulge, which was not the case in the in the play. And, you know, some of the stuff is quite serious. And Wilder did a great job of mixing the comedy with serious drama, you know, when the guy is about to be turned over to the SS and he escapes.
But, right.
You know, it starts with two guys getting killed. You know, it gets right down to business.
Something in Manfredi. Nito, what are their names? Manfredi and something.
Yeah, Manfredi and... Oh, God, I forget.
Yeah.
Manfredi and Johnson or something.
Yeah.
I forget. Mm-hmm. But Truffaut, the one thing I think is weird in the film, Gil Stratton Jr. is the narrator. He's the guy who stutters in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And he became a well-known sportscaster. I don't know if you remember him, but I do.
Huh.
He was an L.A. sportscaster on TV, and he was a sportscaster for football on the national television, and well-known fellow. But he says at the beginning, you know, he narrates, he says, you know, you've seen a lot of World War II films, but you've never seen one about POWs. And, you know, what about Grand Illusion, one of the greatest films ever made? It's about POWs. And so the guy is ignorant of POWs. And it's not just that he's ignorant, but Wilder is counting on the audience to be ignorant. But Wilder obviously saw it because Preminger is kind of a spoof of Eric von Stroheim's character in Grand Illusion.
You know?
And Truffaut says in his review that this guy, obviously, the guys who escape have obviously not seen Grand Illusion, you know, because they get killed going through their tunnel. So that's kind of a sop to, you know, the people in the audience who are kind of ignorant of foreign films. One thing, interesting story about the film, when it came out, Paramount asked Wilder if, they said they were going to change the informer from a German to a Pole so they could play the film in Germany.
Yeah. Okay.
and Wilder was so outraged because, you know, he was from what is now Poland, and his mother and stepfather and grandmother were killed in the Holocaust. And
wow.
So he was outraged that they would do that, and he demanded a change, and they ignored him. They didn't reply to his letters, so he left Paramount after many years, got in his car, and drove off and never came back, you know.
At what point during production did he do that?
That was after it came out.
Okay.
So they were planning the foreign release, and they said, we're going to change the guy to a Pole for the German release.
Oh, I see. The foreign. I got it. Okay. All right.
Yeah. So he left Paramount, and he joined Allied Artists, which was a new company that they made up of a couple small companies. And, but Walter Mirisch was one of the guys who helped form Allied Artists, and... Wilder worked for them, and then the Mirisches formed their own company, you know, and did very well. And Wilder made a whole series of great films for the Mirisch company.
Sure, including 1, 2, 3 and Irma La Douce.
Department, you know.
Right.
So that was, it worked out well for him, I'm happy to report.
You know, when you say that it was necessarily a grim film, comedic, but at the same time grim, what achieves that grimness, I think, is largely the atmosphere outside. It's always muddy, and it's always it feels cold all the time, as opposed to the balmy summer-like weather that The Great Escape takes place in. It's very dry and kind of, you know, in Austria, and you know, not that much of not that far from World War II country club. Really, it's not that bad there. But Selig 17 is an unpleasant environment. You can feel it right away. So I thought
that's a good point. And they filmed it outside of L.A. at a ranch that Paramount had. And yeah, you're right. It was very messy. And Wilder made a point at the beginning of the film. He wore his best shoes and ruined his shoes the first day walking through the mud. And you know, in the film, they put down wooden planks for Otto Preminger to walk on. And Wilder didn't use the wooden planks. He felt that to win the trust of his actors, he had to be as dirty as they were. And yeah, they all got into it. They're all grungy, filthy-looking guys, and Paramount was not happy about that. You know, and another interesting little facet.
What do you mean? Wait, they weren't happy about that it was muddy. They wanted to look pleasant. That's kind of silly, isn't it? To have that. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't know if they objected to the mud, but they objected to the filthiness of the men.
Okay.
And you know, for example, Strauss falls in the mud, and it's very—he's really filthy. He's wearing sort of, what do you call it, pajama
long johns
or something. What do you call that thing where you wear a pajama suit that covers your whole body? You know.
Yeah, I think of it as long johns, but whatever, you know, buttons.
Yeah, we used to call it a bunny suit when we were kids, you know.
Okay.
But he's covered with mud. And he looks horrible, and they didn't like that at all. And Wilder refused to change all that. And, and they're all scruffy and unshaven. Once in a while, they get to shave, but you know, it's really grungy. And it's cold weather. That's true. The cold weather really helps.
Yeah.
Puts them in the mood. And
you know, if you look over the in the distance when you're watching Stalag 17, you notice. I mean, I'm certainly not an authority about Germany, but I've been there a few times. And I've never seen California-type hills and mountains off in the distance. If you know, maybe in Austria there's hills and mountains, but it right away you'd say this is California somewhere. I thought initially when I first saw it that perhaps it was somewhere in the foothills of the San Fernando Valley, maybe somewhere out in the San Joaquin Valley, you know, somewhere out there. But I didn't realize until I read the notes that it's Woodland Hills, of all places.
Yeah, actually, it's right near where the motion picture home is now.
Okay.
But in Austria, they do have a lot of hills and mountains and things, you know. It is in Austria is where it takes place.
Okay, all right.
And Wilder lived in Austria a lot. You know, he was, he lived in Vienna when he was growing up, but he moved from Poland to Austria, but it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the time. It's called, here it is, the ranch in Woodland Hills is where it was prison camp, you know.
Which tells me that, because it does look rather barren on the, when you can get glimpse the outside, so it looks like there wasn't very much development at all, and there really wasn't much of a Woodland Hills as we know it today, which is almost entirely suburban and owned by, you know, there's just homes and shopping malls everywhere, so there's no real
wide open. Yeah, I think that's what it is. I haven't been to that location, but I've been to the motion picture of it. It's all developed around there. And back then, I mean, one thing I've read is if you wanted to get rich in Hollywood, the way to do it was buy land in the valley back in the day, you know.
Right.
Guys like Bob Hope and people like that bought a lot of land, and they had a tremendous fortune from doing that, but that's where they would shoot westerns and things, you know, for wide open spaces near L.A. back then, you know.
I always like telling, I told my son one time we were watching the original Frankenstein that lake is actually near Westlake Village, and those mountains are real. It just happens to be, you know, West Valley in the hilly area, but it's quite picturesque back then. But it's really the romance of that of that area, that geography, is no longer there. At least
was that what they called Sherwood Forest back then? There was a place called Sherwood Forest.
Oh, you're ahead of me on that. I never heard that.
Frank Capra shot part of Lost Horizon. I'm looking. I'll look up Frankenstein. Yeah, that's all been developed, of course, too. And but back then there was a lot of wide open spaces in California. Mm-hmm. One thing I'll mention Hogan's Heroes.
Yeah.
Everybody knows Hogan's Heroes, and
mm-hmm.
In Fablemans is a scene. You remember Spielberg goes to visit the producer of Hogan's Heroes? And,
yeah. Which is just beginning in 65 or something.
When I was a young guy, I was kind of offended by Hogan's Heroes, and I remember talking to Orson Welles about it. I don't know why when I met him.
Mm.
And I said it was offensive to make a comedy in a German prison camp, and he disagreed with me. He liked Hogan's Heroes. He said prison camps were the only place where the Germans had to behave with any decency because, you know, in a prison camp, if you don't treat prisoners well, the guys in the other army won't treat your prisoners well, you know.
Yeah, the word will get back, and right, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, there's an incentive to be somewhat humane, even though they're not very humane, and also the Red Cross, they make a point of showing the Red Cross visiting and, telling them what to do to some extent.
Yeah.
So Wells thought it was legitimate. If you're going to get any humor out of World War II, that's one way you could do it. You know?
Incidentally, I also read last night that there apparently the film shot in early 53, and they didn't have a lot of post-production time like they do these days, and apparently the intention was to bring it out very quickly, but it was delayed for a year. No, let me take this back. It might have been shot in 52, but they delayed it for a year, according to this one thing I read. And it was something to do with Paramount didn't think that people would want to see a prisoner of war camp, and yet some POWs from Korea were released, and that comment was a. Is there anything to that story? Or is that just BS or what?
That I never heard. That's all news to me.
Okay.
I'm looking up. It says here it was filmed in early '52, but it came out a year later. You're right that there is a long time before it came out. That is. I hadn't noticed that before, actually, you know.
Now,
I'm not sure what the story is about that.
Hmm. Now, when Holden, of course, he shot up pretty big after Sunset Boulevard, but the conventional wisdom is that he didn't really become Bill Holden, the superstar, until he won the Oscar. Would you concur with that?
I think you're right. I mean, you know, it's not like Sunset Boulevard, he was very good, but it was really Gloria Swanson's picture, you know, and Holden played a pretty unsympathetic character. Although, I mean, every screenwriter loves Joe Gillis,
yeah.
Joe Gillis in that film because we all relate to him, you know.
Yeah.
And he's a very likable fellow, but he's very morally compromised. But Sound Like 17, yeah, it made him, the public loved that character, and he went on to a whole series of, you know, romantic roles. He did Sabrina for Wilder, and and then he did, you know, Bridge on the River Kwai, and that made him like a big superstar. He was really getting huge salaries in that time. Horse Soldiers.
Yep.
He and Wayne each got $750,000 for that. It's an awful lot of money in those days. You know?
And that movie didn't actually work commercially, even though that happens to be one of my favorite John Fords of all time. But it didn't work commercially. Horse Soldiers.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. I did the commentary for that, and it has some wonderful stuff, but a lot of things that aren't very good, you know. But, I mean, actually, there's a good story. The screenwriter, John Lee Mann, told me he went to see the film. It opened weekly, poorly, and he went to see it about a week after it opened, and he was sitting next to a woman who said, "Oh, for God's sake, no man hates doctors so much." And he said that was true. That was, like, it seems very irrational for John Wayne to be full of hatred for doctors all the way through the movie. It seems like a plot device they were using, you know?
Yeah.
But Holden's very likable in that film, and but he had his drinking problem, which kind of screwed up his career to some extent. But I love Holden. He's a wonderful actor, isn't he? I mean,
me too. But, you know, when you look at it, if you talk about his golden period beginning with Stella 17 and ending, really, there really wasn't anything great after the Horse Soldiers until Network, really. I mean, he did some interesting films, Alvarez Kelly, and I'm trying to think of something that was noteworthy in the late 60s. Oh, what am I talking about? The Wild Bunch. I'm sorry, I take that back.
Yeah, he did The Wild Bunch. I'll tell you a funny story about that. Howard Hawks told me Hawks hated The Wild Bunch just because it was very different from his kind of filming, but he said he went to see it and somebody said, what did you think of Holden? And he said, was Holden in that film? And the person told him who Holden played, and Hawks said, that old man? He didn't recognize Holden, you know, in the film. I mean, he had aged a lot because of the drinking, and in Wilder's Fedora, I think he's very good, but he looks really ravaged in that film, you know. But a film that's really good is SOB, the Blake Edwards film.
I completely agree with that. Actually, I completely agree. That was probably the last... Was that before or after Fedora? I can't remember, but that was...
It's his last film, 1981. I felt really terrible when he died, you know, that terrible way he died, too.
Yeah.
You know, he hit his head on a metal table. He was drunk, and he bled to death on the floor of his apartment. You know,
what a waste. I really loved him also in Clint Eastwood's little film, Breezy. I thought that was an excellent little character piece that I believed.
Yeah, he was good.
You know.
He was good, and I'm looking here. The TV movie, The Blue Knight, he was good.
That was pretty noteworthy, as I remember. Yeah, that was good. Was that a...
Wild Rovers is a good film, you know.
Which one?
Wild Rovers with Ryan O'Neill.
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess I don't mean that he didn't do good work after Horse Soldiers, but his big star, you know, huge salary period, you know, he was quite the man at that point, but it really didn't even last a decade when you get down to it. I mean, unless you want to count Sunset Boulevard. What did he do immediately after Sunset Boulevard, but before? Didn't he do a couple of nondescript programmers?
Yeah, he did some crummy films. Union Station. One film he did was a good film, but he doesn't have a great role. It's Born Yesterday. He's the romantic guy in that film, you know.
Judy Holliday. Yeah.
Yeah, he wears glasses and he's a journalist and he's a serious kind of guy. But it's not a showy part. But
yeah,
he did Force of Arms, Submarine Command, not very good films. The Moon is Blue was an interesting film that he did.
Premature. Yeah. And that was known for being kind of risque in terms of the sexual content, right?
Yeah, it had, you know, talked about her being a virgin, which caused a controversy at the time, you know, which is kind of absurd. He was in The Country Girl, which got Grace Kelly an Oscar, you know.
Well, that was after, that was 54, right? After,
It was after Sabrina, and another film he was very good in is Picnic. It's a pretty good film.
I agree.
Not a great film, but River Kwai was a huge success.
Yeah, that was probably the...
It was sort of spotty. He made some choices that weren't so good, maybe, in some of the films, too.
One of the things I've never forgiven my father for was he liked to go to movies to avoid the crowd, so we would always go and arrive at the film maybe 20 minutes to a half hour before it ended, see the ending, wait for the next show, and then leave at the 2/3 mark. I absolutely despise that. But River Kwai was one of the ones that he destroyed for me by doing that.
Oh, that's too bad. It's funny how we used to watch movies. We'd go in the middle and all that.
Yeah.
Because, I'm glad we don't do that anymore. But there's a lot to say about, you know, I mean, one thing, Wilder left Diamond partly because Diamond was very conservative, and Wilder was liberal.
Okay.
And they had a violent argument about HUAC, and Brackett was in favor of the hearings, and he thought Dalton Trumbo should have admitted he was a communist and all this kind of stuff. And Wilder said, "I spit on the Congress of the United States," which is quite a thing to say for you know, patriotic foreigner who came to America and was grateful to be here.
Right.
But Wilder said, "I want to be more politically daring than Brackett would allow him to be." Foreign Affair is a remarkably good film. It's a very sharp satire of how the army was. You know, I mean, actually, it's more attack in Congress. The Gene Arthur character is kind of like a Sarah Palin type, And that film caused controversy, and Brackett was not too thrilled about that. But in the 50s, Wilder had to disguises social themes because of the blacklist and everything. And so what they would do is, I mean, John Ford, somebody asked Ford after